and welcome to An Evening with Nirvana. It's a podcast where I talk to various guests from the Doom community about level design, map making, and content creation. Today I'm talking to Matt Tropiano, also known as M-Trop, a longtime community member. You'll likely know him for wads like Coffee Break and Forsaken Overlook, as well as a major contributor to the Adventures of Square 1 and 2. He's also created a number of useful tools for the community over the years, including Doomstruct, Wad Tools, and Wad Merge, and also a contributor to Doom Radio. Welcome to the podcast, M-Trop. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, exciting. I was just saying before we started that you've had quite a career, so a lot to get through.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, don't forget Deco Hack and that Doom Tool stuff. That's seen a lot of use now. It's
yeah, but, I wanted to talk about later on a little bit about your contributions to like MBF and stuff, and I've played a little with Deco Hack, and boy is it a quality of life improvement. So
I hope so, because like I originally made that to make vanilla mods easier, but yeah, with the recent additions to a lot of other dehackedry, it's going to probably see a lot more use in that, so I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, it is really fantastic. Like, I don't think people will go back to Wackhead after Deco Hack.
Well, I don't want it to completely replace that. I mean, like, there's always a place for GUI editors and stuff like that, for smaller scale projects or what have you, but like, yeah, as long as people have options, I'm happy.
Yeah, that's true for sure. So I'll start us off with the mundane one that everybody gets. How did you get into Doom initially?
Well, when I was a younger lad, about like 10 or 11, I got a computer that could play Doom. And before that, I usually played a lot of games that had like level editors in them, so I could like make my own like maps and levels and whatever. For those games, and because I just liked creating stuff, and I used to draw like little mazes and I don't know, levels for Mario Brothers or whatever, just on notebooks and whatever. And having a computer that could and games that could let you make more of that game was really interesting to me. And so Doom was like another one of those games where everybody was playing it. And then, yeah, when I got a computer that could eventually play Doom, I installed the shareware version, and it was really fun. And eventually I got my hands on the full versions and Doom and Doom 2. And then I bought this book called The Doom Hacker's Guide by Hank Lukert. And it had like, it was like just this big, thick paperback book on how to tinker around with Doom and make maps for it, and how to use the editors that came on this CD that the book also came with. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was how I got my start. But I didn't make anything for Doom. I like made stuff for Heretic very early on, but but then, like, I just started making stuff for Doom because that's where everybody else kind of was. So, but yeah, I stayed within the Doom engine a lot, and that's where it all started.
Mm-hmm. So, it was your first love actually Heretic? Were you hoping that you would be making more stuff for them?
It wasn't my first love, but it was like another game that I could make stuff for, and I think my friend Bill, who worked with me on The Best WoD Ever way back when, had like ideas for like Heretic maps that he wanted to see made. So I'm like, okay, maybe I can make some of these. And then I tried like replicating what his design was, and then later on made my own maps. And then, yeah, we worked together on stuff, and then I don't know, I just kept working on things.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm a little curious, like, out of TNT and Plutonia, when those came around, did you play them when they initially came out?
Yes, I did. So I played TNT solo, and then I played Plutonia with, yeah, my friend Bill. co-op all the way through. And I think at the time TNT was my favorite because it had all new music and what have you, and it was like very much like a TNT project. But then I don't know, over time I grew to love Plutonia far more just because of its map design and its a little bit more difficult gameplay. So that became my favorite of the two. Yeah.
Interesting. And I'm curious, looking at the Doom Wiki, I was wondering what the mat add-ons were, because I couldn't find like a download or anything.
Oh, that's on my it's on my website. You can find that download. It's the mat add-ons is just an episode for Heretic that I made, which is really old and really bad. And it was it also included like every MIDI I could find for new music, and like which included like canyon.mid and passport.mid, like the ones that came with Windows. So yeah, that was like kind of an early foray into like making stuff. And I showed it off to a couple of friends, and like I distributed it via like diskette. So I gave them like copies of that like early on, and they were just like, "Wow, this is really cool." But I think it's like, you know, they were just like thrilled, I guess, because they knew somebody who could make maps, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, receiving new content for something that, like, I feel like you weren't expecting to ever get new content for is always cool anyway, I think, if you enjoy the game.
Yeah, and I was the guy who was making the new content among my circle of friends, so that was a... And, you know, I encouraged them to make stuff, too, but, like, I don't know. It's, I was the one doing it.
And what about the best WOD ever, which you did mention briefly?
So, the best WOD ever, that was with me and Bill. We made enough maps to, like, make about, like, a replacement for three episodes. So, we just mushed them all together and released it as like a giant megawad, and that too is on my website. It's not it was published to AOL's file servers initially, America Online, and that really didn't see... I'm not even sure if many people downloaded that or whatever, but like at the time people were just like looking for new stuff to play, so maybe, I don't know, but yeah, that was like a big release for like two, I guess. Well, how old were we at the time? I think 12, 11, 12. So like really young, and thinking like, you know, this is like the best shit we've ever made, and rightfully so, because, you know, we didn't have a frame of reference. But like, I mean, compared to the stuff I make now, it like looks like terrible, like with all the stuff, you know, like all my contributions and whatever. But like, I don't know, it has like a certain old charm to it, like and a lot of I'd say anthropological value in terms of like old stuff being out there for people to see and whatnot. So I don't know, I'm like a big, like one of my big things is making sure that old stuff is still available for people to peruse.
Yeah. Well, I think it, like, when you look back on your own stuff like that as well, you remember, like, all the struggles you had, and, like, when I look at my old stuff, it's like, I remember how difficult it was to, like, make my first line trigger, and you know, like, just things like that. Yeah. Especially in those, like, old editors. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, everybody starts from somewhere, and having your old work somewhere for people to see is just, like, I don't know, like... It's inspiring to me because, like, very, like, people want to, like, kind of always put their best foot forward and, like, make it so that, or at least I think that, like, there's been a rash of that in the Doom community where people would want to have their, like, old work taken down, like, not out of, like, content reasons, but, like, out of quality reasons.
Yeah.
And kind of like make it so that like the only things that they've ever released were good. And I understand like the mentality behind that, but it's like, I don't know, personally, I want all my old stuff up there as well, just to show people that, yeah, I came from a really amateurish, terrible place when my skills were kind of garbage. And nowadays, I'm, you know, the next thing I make is, you know, better than the last thing. And hopefully there's like a lineage of improvement with all of my work up to this point. So I just think it's important for people to like keep old work around, especially if they've released that old work already, because you don't know who you'll inspire from that point.
Yeah, and I think it's also important for new mappers to see you can start from here and end up here, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, and I think it's a little bit fruitless, like, trying to pretend you didn't begin with, like, a few boxes glued together, you know? Like, everyone does, so there's no point kind of pretending.
Yeah, but you don't have to, like, release everything you make. Like, there's definitely people in the Doom scene that have, like, made a whole lot of stuff for a very long time and just, you know, started releasing recently, and it looks like they just kind of came out of nowhere. Like, yeah. I mean, I'm specifically thinking of Bridgeburner, like, who's been making maps for, like, a really long time, but, like, only started publishing them, like, I don't know, like, 6 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yep.
So I think every once in a while he plays through his old stuff, like, on his streams and whatever, so if you catch that, then there's definitely, like, old stuff that he has lying around, but they were just never published. Mm-hmm. And I think you shouldn't publish everything that you make, but I mean you should publish it if you're proud of the work. So I could safely say that I'm proud of all the stuff that I've put out so far. Well, I guess maybe there's like one or two things I'm not particularly proud of, because they were just like crappy throwaway maps, but mm-hmm. But then, like, I would say 95% of what I've released had some pride attached to it because of the amount of work I put into it with the skills I had at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely important. So to move on to Dimensions of Time, you were talking about how, like, TNT was sort of what you enjoyed more initially when you play the iWoods, and I feel like this WoD in particular feels like very TNT inspired, like in terms of visuals and gameplay and stuff. Was this like a deliberate thing, or?
I mean, if you looked at the first map, yeah, pretty deliberate. Yeah. Like the first the map opening, is very much map 01 of TNT, but in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It's safe to say that that was very heavily influenced by TNT, and kind of has its like old school kitsch to it, and just the use of like ensuring that like new music was in the WAD file and stuff like that. But yeah, it was very heavily TNT inspired, and I'm very glad that you picked up on that. Because like it is kind of it screams amateurish, but with love put into it, or at least the amount of love and skill that a 12 or 13-year-old could put into anything like that.
Yeah, you mentioned the MIDI, and there's like I think there's like Blur in there, and there's like a bunch of Sublime. Was this just like a playlist of like your favorite music at the time?
Yeah, like a playlist of like all sorts of 90s music that was the popular, or songs that I liked and whatever that I could find MIDI arrangements of. Like, I mean, these days you'd want to credit everybody that you put your, you know, whose work you put into your work, but like I had no idea who the made a lot of these MIDIs and whatever, if they weren't like, you know, straight from Doom or or whatever. Like it would be hard to find the credits now unless they were embedded in those MIDI files, but I used MIDI to MUS to convert all of them, so you wouldn't be able to find them in the metadata, unfortunately, of the music lumps. So I'm afraid those are lost to the sands of time. But I'm sure there's like some way of maybe finding them one day. It's just been such a long time.
Well, yeah, someone can really dig into that that mystery later on, I think.
Yeah, 13-year-old me didn't think of actually like finding every single last credit and putting it in the text file. I mean, of course, an older me is like far more conscious of that stuff, but I don't know. Teenage me, not so much.
Right. So I guess you'd already sort of made a Mega Wad with your friend Bill, but
yeah.
What was the experience of making 32 maps?
I guess if I have to go back quite a bit to like remember. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it was coming up with ideas for maps, which is, I mean, the struggle today. If anybody wants to attempt a megawatt of that size, because like it's a lot, and you don't want things to become samey or boring or what have you. And it's just, I don't know. Like when I was younger, I had like just a huge amount of ideas. But then like, you know, when you get older and then you have like, you know, better or what you think is better mapping sensibilities and gameplay sensibilities, it's harder to come up with new ideas, because a lot of your old ideas are kind of you know, used already. But then I don't know, it's there's nobody that's like, I mean, there's nobody that says like you can't cannibalize your previous ideas if you think you can execute on them better. But like, yeah, the struggle to come up with unique ideas for each map is probably the toughest part of making something of that size. So that's why I usually stick to smaller things these days, rather than really large things. Although I'm kind of in the process of making a very large thing at the moment. So, yeah, whatever. It's right. Just, I'm all over the place. But yeah, if you have the ideas, then you'll be able to make something of that size.
Yeah, I agree that coming up with the ideas can be the tricky part. Although sometimes it's the other way around for me. I feel like sometimes I'll have like this kernel of an idea, and then the tricky part is like actually turning that concept into the map. So you know, it definitely goes both ways.
Yeah, I mean, like, and just to turn the idea into a map comes with the comes with the confidence that you can, one, you could pull off the idea, and two, the idea has been executed well enough that you don't have to like add more to the map. Like, like you don't want to like pad out, like you have the idea and that was fun, and then add more to the map just to pad out its length or whatever, because like it may be too short or like not long enough to like fit with the rest of the maps. I don't know. Like, that's something I struggle with, is this map going to occupy enough time in terms of play time? And do I have like the central idea already fleshed out well enough? 'Cause like, I remember when, some feedback that I got from, you know, Tarnsman, that mapper, he always got annoyed when people struggled to use all three keys in every map, and like I was no different. And so like now I have to like accept using like less than three keys in a map in order to complete an idea, because like you don't have to use like all the parts of the animal that you're trying to flesh out here, but you know, using just enough is still a struggle. And just, yeah, because like there, you get a lot of people that want to do the what people start to call the magnum opus syndrome, where it's like, will people remember this map if I don't make it like spectacular or whatever? But like I still struggle within my own work to like let things stand alone as they are, and hopefully create a memorable enough experience.
Yeah, I do feel like unless I'm fully prepared for the experience, or I trust the mapper to make like a very engaging lengthy map, my heart does sink sometimes when I see that I need like 6 keys for a switch.
Yeah. it's like, never fun because like then you have a gauge of like how long the map is actually going to take you, and then if you have that, like, that's the worst feeling to give a player, is just that sinking feeling of like, oh man, how much time is this going to, like, like the anticipation of the time used should never be a feeling that the player has, especially if like they already didn't enjoy what came up to that point. So it's just like, oh, that's more of a slog this time. But like, I don't know. It's not really a double-edged sword, but it's like, I guess, yeah, map length could be a double-edged sword, because like if they liked what they played thus far, then, and they're like, oh, there's going to be more, great. And if they didn't like what they played thus far, and they're like, oh my god, it's another long map, then it's not so good.
Yeah. If it's someone like Tourniquet or something, like, I trust him, you know? A newer mapper or something, it's like, well, maybe like 3 to 4 of these keys will be engaging to find, and then the rest of them might be in for it.
One would hope, yeah.
So there's like a bit of a difficulty ramp up in Dimensions of Time. Was this just sort of a natural thing of wanting to make the maps harder, or were you playing more difficult content as you went and it sort of naturally tilted that way?
I think I wanted to make them harder and harder as they progressed. Like, I had like this video gamey progression in mind for how maps should go. So the difficulty ramp, I try to make the difficulty ramp go higher and higher and higher, or keep introducing new things to the player. At least I try to do that. Like, now, if I have like a, if I'm working with a completely new set of resources or what have you, like for like new monsters or new textures that I can like make different locales or whatever, I try to have a progression within that, just so the player is given something new to deal with. And then there will be a, what I call the, if you've ever played the Mega Man games on Nintendo or whatever, like each of the Robot Master maps have like their own little style and their own like encounters that are new. And then what I call you get the Dr. Wily stage when you've beaten all the Robot Masters and you gotta face Dr. Wily. And then it takes all the stuff you've learned and then like turns a lot of it on its head in order to like throw new things at you and new encounters. So that's what I try to do in a lot of like progression with maps today, not just difficulty. But like, yeah, back then it was just a difficulty ramp up, because that's what I felt you had to do when you were making a lot of maps. They just had to get harder and harder. And I mean, I think a lot of people follow that pattern anyway with stuff they make, so it's like a pretty easy pattern to follow, especially if people have encountered everything in Doom before. So it's like, what can you throw at them that's new? And then you'd want to have a little bit of a difficulty curve with later maps, just to keep the player engaged.
Yep, for sure. So Bloody Base and For Dear Life, you made these in Zeth, Zdoom mod editor. Could you talk a bit about that program and just also like these maps in general and why they came about?
So when I said that 95% of my work I was proud of, this is the 5%.
Yeah. Okay.
There were two maps. There were two maps I just made in Zdoom, because like Zdoom was new and I'm like, oh, I could do scripting and stuff, and there's stealth monsters, let's use those. And everybody hates stealth monsters. Yeah. So what I did was, I made those two maps. And Zeth was a Zdoom, it could edit Zdoom maps, and it was based on Death, which was another DOS-based editor. So I had that editor to make ZDoom maps, and I used that to make them. Like, I mean, Death and Zeth worked a lot like Deep did. It was like a graphical editor where you draw sectors and stuff like that. So it wasn't really too difficult to use because, like, I think I used Deep for Dimensions of Time, right? So it hopping from Deep to Zeth was not really that huge of a jump because a lot of editors, like, kind of borrowed from each other at the time in terms of functionality. So it wasn't really that much of a huge difference. But yeah, the lineage for of Zeth is Death, which was like the previous Doom editing something. I forgot what it stood for, but yeah.
And I feel like you never really got super into like the ZDoom and more feature heavy ports. Was there sort of the particular reasons why you tend to prefer sticking to like just limit removing?
I think there's just it's less analysis paralysis with features, I guess. I mean, I don't really have a issue working with like ZDoom and GZDoom and what have you because I had to do that for the Adventures of Square. I guess there's just a nice simplicity to the less feature heavy versions of the Doom engine, but and I don't know. Like, I guess I used what was familiar to me, and you could see that in what was it, Scourge of Viscerus, that Hexen hub that I made. That's like that was kind of being made around this this same time, like a little later into the early 2000s, and that was made, I think, with WAD Author and I forget what else, but maybe Doom Builder later. I don't know, but like, I would use just the engine features that would allow me to realize whatever design or vision, or at least give me some breathing room, because making things for vanilla Hexen is still very difficult because I wasn't too sure where the limits lied in that. So ZDoom gave me some breathing room and some additional features to use. So I only really use what I want to use and not try to go completely overboard with features and try to fit things into whatever engine I'm using. Because like the thing is, I mean as ubiquitous as GZDoom is, you still find a greater range of what's the word I'm looking for? You still find a greater range of use for anything made in like an earlier engine genetically from the later engines that we have. So the goal is for people to play or work, right? So accessibility becomes a concern, at least with me, for people playing whatever of mine. And like, I mean, there is a time and a place for using more feature rich stuff, and I've made that stuff as well. So it's like, it's not like I really have a preference. I just, you know, you pick the tools for the job. And if you don't need to use those more feature rich tools, you don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. So Zexus, it's like a giant sprawling map you released in 2006, I believe.
Yeah.
What made you want to make sort of one big map instead of, you know, lots of smaller maps in a Megawatt style?
So that was originally going to be part of... So Community Chess 3 was not originally going to be a map set for the Boom engine. It was actually going to be a ZDoom map set because what was it, the first community chest was like I think regular Doom or Boom, and the second one was Boom, and then the third one was going to be ZDoom, and then I started making a map for that, and it was going to be like map 28 because I got that slot. But then I think it was originally like called off, and then someone else picked up Community Chest 3 to be like another boom level set. So I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with this? And then I'm like, well, might as well release it standalone. And you could tell it really has like a little bit of Magnum Opus syndrome in it, knowing that like it was supposed to be part of like a larger group of maps. So yeah, large enough to, I guess, stand on its own as a completed work. So that's how I ended up releasing it.
Yeah, you talk about the Magnum Opus syndrome a little bit, and I do feel like around that time in particular, you got a lot of community projects with like lots of gigantic maps in them. It seemed like around that time, people really felt like, I got to make something very big so that people sort of notice my map amongst everyone else's.
Yeah, and I'm definitely guilty of that, and I learned the hard way that is not like, it's not really the way you ought to be doing things, because not only that, if you have to play through your work and test it, and it's a long, a gigantic map, it's just a huge pain in the ass to test, and you're just wasting a lot of time doing playtesting, and the problems just compound like exponentially as the map grows. So I don't know. That's why I like start making like smaller stuff now. Like I don't have the time I used to. So, everything else gets simpler when the maps are smaller. And, there's a huge fallacy to, making your map like large and involved, and it'll immediately be memorable. And that's not always the case, because if the map isn't like fun to play, then people will remember it, but for not very good reasons. And if you look at what is that list of the 100 most memorable maps of all time, on Doomworld, it's like, you know, you do get some that are good memorable and some that are really bad memorable. And some of them, or a bunch of them, come from community projects. So, yeah, it's get a very mixed bag, and it's a very big gamble if you, throw a huge production into what's supposed to be like a collaborative effort. And, yeah, everybody wants to stand out, but you'd hope you stand out for the right reasons.
Yeah, CC2 had some wild ones. I remember playing through that.
Yeah.
So Community Chest was like your first community project, I think, at least listed on the Doom Wiki.
Let me think. Yeah, I'd say so. I think that was like the first time I actually... it was loosely collaborative. So...
Yeah.
So, like, it was just, like, yeah, claim map slots and make a map in that slot. And, like, there really was, I don't think there was any other direction really in it. Like, I mean, there was just the, we're using these resources and what have you for the WOD. But I think I just made stuff with, like, stock textures rather than anything new, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, it was like loosely collaborative, but that was like good enough starting out for me with like larger collaborative projects. Like a lot of the efforts of the Doom community way back when didn't even have forums to coordinate. They used mailing lists, and I don't know how the hell they did that, but
right. But
like they still made at work anyway. And I was, you know, we're lucky these days to have like a forum and stuff like Discord and Dropbox for just like asking people to, like, you know, for collaboration, for like live collaboration and stuff like that. So things are a hell of a lot better than they used to be today, but like, you know, back then, you know, you still, you know, you use the tools you have. And so for me, that contribution and the way I contributed was good enough in terms of starting out in a community project.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested because you seemed There are some people who start just doing community projects and eventually work themselves up to making their own stuff, but you started like pretty self-sufficiently, like just, I mean, you worked with your friend on early stuff, but then making a lot of projects by yourself. So I was interested in sort of what made you decide, like, oh, I'll take part in this community project rather than making your own ward.
Just because it was, because like around that time, I think I was doing a bunch of stuff for Quake and Duke Nukem 3D and Shadow Warrior, some of which I've released, some of which I haven't. But then like I was looking to get back into Doom because I don't know, Z Doom seemed pretty enticing, and oh yeah, it was like what was it? Void, that WoD made by Mike Watson, Cybe. That's kind of like what pulled me back into Doom and Z Doom and the like, because I was like, oh my God, people could do crazy shit with Doom now, and I want in on this action. So I asked around like what the current projects people are working on, and maybe I could you know, lend a hand and stuff, because like, you know, I yeah, as you said, I've had a lot of experience with solo projects and or very very small team projects, and yeah, that was just another way to start contributing again. I mean, I feel like a lot of people really should start out making stuff for themselves, just so they understand the tools and understand the engines that they're working with, and just understanding the process. Because, I mean, it's good to be a part of something. It's good to be a part of like a large community effort, but like you, I don't know. Some I personally would want my contributions to shine along with others rather than like be, dare I say, propped up by others or something like that. Because like I don't know. I have a lot of insecurities about about my work sometimes. Like they may not be felt in the final product, but they're definitely there. Like the whole imposter syndrome thing and all that stuff. So yeah, like I want to make sure I can do a good job before I start adding to another person's project.
Yeah, of course. I can definitely understand those sentiments as well. So speaking of community projects, and to sort of harken back to something you talked about earlier, you made maps for Plutonia Revisited, which I guess because I'd seen you as somebody who liked TNT quite a bit more, it was interesting. It was this sort of like the period where you started to appreciate Plutonia a little bit more. Was that what attracted you to the project?
Yeah, like, and I had a lot of like nostalgia for Plutonia at the time. So, and I haven't made vanilla maps in a while, so I started making vanilla maps again for PRCP. I think they're all vanilla. Yeah, they're all vanilla. So, it was fun to work with those limitations again, but because like the last time I worked with those limitations, I wasn't really that great a mapper, and now I was a lot more improved, and I started I had to kind of like think in like more creative ways of how to pull off what I want to pull off in PRCP, because like you know, the designs, my designs got like a little bit more like a little bit more busy and a little bit more complex, and I'm like, well, how do I make this work in Vanilla Doom with its constraints? So it was a really good challenge to like contribute to that project, and that was like kind of like one of the big reasons why I wanted to contribute to it.
Yeah, and the map 6 Stony Halls, and I mean, I feel like the other maps too have a lot of hit scanners in them. Was this sort of paying homage to Plutonia or TNT, or is that just sort of the gameplay that you liked to promote?
I mean, when the project was proposed, it was supposed to be kind of like Plutonia-ish. So yeah, a lot of hit scanners kind of made their way into that map and others. The whole goal was to make a megawatt in 6 months, just like Dario and Milo Casali did with the Plutonia experiment. Mm-hmm. I believe, yeah, Joshi headed PRCP, right? So he was like, yeah, we're making this in 6 months and maybe have one more month for playtesting and what have you. And the idea was to make it as, like, you know, Plutonia-like as possible. And, like, some maps were like that, some maps weren't. And mine, I think, probably weren't by the end of it. But initially, I tried to recapture the Plutonia magic a little bit with the earlier maps that I contributed.
So you also seem to quite like a hot start, which is something that I've noticed in sort of your later ones, like Coffee Break as well. Is this something very conscious, or do your maps just sort of generally take that shape when you make them?
I like hot starts sometimes because, or at least, like, you know, the start where, like, everybody's facing away from you until you, like, make a sound, and mm-hmm. then, like, everybody just jumps on you. Like, just to have that... like, gameplay element of survival, or, like, finding, like, the weapon that isn't the pistol to, like, help you out immediately. And I like trying to pull the player into firefights that they otherwise would want to avoid, just so, like, there's some, like, reward at the end of that, and they have to fight their way back. So, like, I liking a lot of that that type of gameplay style, you do have a lot of maps that have the hot start, so you push the player into situations where they may not be as comfortable. And, like, I mean, you want the player to be not comfortable, but, like, still feel accomplished when they make it out alive of certain battles and mm-hmm. and enemy setups and whatever, because, like, you know, getting that feeling of accomplishment is what you want the player to have. And it's difficult to do when, you know, you just give them a cushy experience and, like, have monsters in hallways and you know, you just hold down the fire button and they're gone and whatever. So I'm a fan of the hot start simply because you have to get the player to move. Mm-hmm. And that's what I enjoy making them do.
Yeah, there is something enjoyable about that, like, big burst of combat and stuff at the beginning, and then you gradually get, like, a foothold, and then you can kind of, like, breathe for a second. I think Skepland is probably the WOD that I think of the most for that kind of gameplay.
Mm, yeah.
So where did the initial idea for Coffee Break come from, and what were, like, your main inspirations at the time?
So the main idea for Coffee Break came from two places. One, I was sick of making large maps because I've I've said it a lot that I hated making Community Chest 3 Map 29 because of how large it was. And I ended up hating it at the end because of, like, how much of a pain in the ass it was to playtest and how, like, just indulgent it was. Because, like, it was kind of, like, supposed to be an Eric Alm ripoff map, and it had, like, just hordes of enemies in it, and it succeeded at that, but, like, I got really sick of making maps that big. Mm-hmm. So Coffee Break was kind of a retaliation against making, personal retaliation against, like, making large maps and seeing what I can do in making a map that didn't overstay its welcome, just stuck around for maybe, like, 5 minutes at a time. And the other inspiration for it was this megawad by Wim Vanry, who made the mini level megawad, and each of those maps could be completed in about a minute, and they, like, had, like, one little idea in them, and that's just what the map was, just, like, one little idea per map. and like almost like WarioWare-ish. And right. And so I was like, oh, I could do something like that, but I'd want the maps to be a little bit longer. So yeah, Coffee Break became that, just like execution on an idea, but then like the maps would just be like maybe 5 minute long maps. The later maps in it became about seven minutes, 9 minutes, 11 minutes long, but the initial idea was there just to keep them short. Like I just imagined somebody booting up Doom in the middle of work, playing a map, and then being done. Mm-hmm. So, and then back to work. So yeah, the amount of time of a coffee break. And that's how... and like I guess the third inspiration was... Kornel Kizielowicz, who made the Doom roguelike, and also Jupiter Hell. If you haven't played it, it's great. Go ahead and buy it. It's amazing. He coined the term coffee break roguelike. And so I borrowed that terminology for coffee break, and so that's where that came from.
And were these mostly speed maps, or was that not necessarily your process?
No, they were not speed maps at all. Like some maps would take like a week or two to make and detail or what have you. I think I made it over the course of 3 years, so it was just like really sporadic, like the times I would work on it. Yeah, that's how long that took. I originally wanted it to be like, as I said in the text file for Coffee Break, I wanted it to be 32 maps, but I was just like, nah, I don't have the time to like make 32 maps, so I'm just going to release 11 maps, like a short Doom 2 episode, and be done with it. And I call it Episode 1 and leave it open for later episodes, which I have not made.
Well, you know, I think... In those cases, I think it helps it more than hinders it that it's a bit shorter, though, because it kind of fits with the theme, honestly. And I think like Vanguard was originally meant to be a megawatt, if I remember correctly, when I talked to
Skillsaw. Oh yeah, Skillsaw. I love Vanguard. Like I love yeah, just too. As much I love a lot of Skillsaw's work too. And it's good to see. It's good to see that like other people play it as well. So yeah, we all have good taste, I guess.
I think Vanguard's just a very good example of that same thing, though. Of I think it's helped by the fact that it's a bit shorter. I think a lot of Slaughter people tend to quite like Vanguard because he said that. Yeah, that's right. What Skillsaw said was that it was going to be a megawatt. And some of the maps that you play later in it were meant to be sort of map, you know, like 16, map 20, map 25. So that's why the difficulty curve is like a little more crushed down. So you end up with some like bigger spikes, which he suggested might be why people who like more difficult stuff might sort of angle themselves towards Vanguard, which was interesting. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it is. I think it still might be my favorite of his. With Coffee Break, I was wondering about sort of the fundamentals in terms of sort of design philosophy, I guess, for the maps, because it felt like a lot of them were built around the chain gun and the rocket launcher placement, so the player could like punch through packs of low tier enemies. Was that sort of your thought process?
I mean, that was I do like the catharsis that comes with a lot of like enemy killing with like a bigger weapons, but like I want those moments to be earned rather than like just given to the player. So like you're either like fighting for a bit with like lower tier weapons, or you're facing like enemies that are like outside of outside of the strength of like what your weapons have, and then you get that like one weapon that will deal with a whole lot of enemies, and then yeah, you just mow them down. I like moments like that. I try to like do that stuff with at the very least the rocket launcher, because like it's still like one of those like hazardous weapons that like if you misuse it, you're gonna end up eating your own rockets. But yeah, just stuff like that. I like kind of dragging the player through in order to get the catharsis that they want.
Mm-hmm. And moving on from Coffee Break, what's interesting is you've talked a bit about, like you said, you made Coffee Break because you were tired of making giant maps, but then Forsaken Overlook, how did that sort of begin?
So Forsaken Overlook, so I think I talked about this in my Video Brains talk that I did in like 2016. If you haven't watched that, go ahead and watch it. It's great. I'm told. So I'm told. But I said that, like, okay, so it was like part of the Secret Santa project that was started by this Doomer Snakes, and he kind of did the thing where it's like everybody puts their name in a hat and you draw another author and then you had to mimic that author. Uh-huh. And the person I was given was Loopings Castman, and he's known for making really large maps. Mm-hmm. So that's why I had to make a really large map and then like kind of like investigate his style and then try to mimic it. And so that was that. That was why it was a large map yet again. Right. So, I mean, if I had a, you know, an author that did smaller maps, it would have been a smaller map. But nope, it was a larger map. So, yeah. And then I released it standalone because everybody else was supposed to release their stuff standalone. And I think 16 people participated in the Secret Santa, and only 4 people actually made maps, which sucks. But... Right. I don't know. I saw it as an opportunity to kind of like grow in terms of skill or, yeah, like in terms of like just mapping skill, like try to imitate somebody else's style. And yeah. I think I succeeded in some places and not so much in others. Like there's some definite Loopings Castmanisms, like the message right at the beginning of the map that kind of like spells out what might go on in the rest of the map, or like just sets the scene. And uses of color and walkways and stuff like that, and then just this huge sense of scale with like satellite locations throughout. But yeah, it's still very much a mixture of my style and his, which I think is like pretty much the goal of that whole project. It's like, how much can you mimic the other person, but then still kind of make it your own? And I think I succeeded in that.
Yeah, always. I think I've never had to, or I've never sort of done one of those things where you mimic someone else's style, but it seems very challenging to me.
We really should bring that back, because it did create some interesting results for the, you know, the people that actually did make maps.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also nice to have something like celebratory of sort of other mappers.
Yeah.
Was there sort of a lot of pre-planning that you did for the map then, in terms of progression? When you have something large like that, is that something you usually do?
Yeah, for this case, I think I wrote a postmortem of my experience. It's up on my website. I wrote a postmortem of my approach to making Forsaken Overlook, because I had to do a lot of research into Loopings Castman's maps. So, like, what I found was that he does have a distinct style and approach to his maps, and I'm like, well, now I'm looking at the product. Now I have to kind of, like, get into the mindset of, like, of developing ideas around that sort of map design. And so a lot of it was playing a lot of his older work and recent work, and then trying to find some common threads in those that I could work with and build a map using those common characteristics.
Mm-hmm. And what is... sort of your general process for monster placement? Is that Do you think about combat as you're building? Do you have specific combat set pieces in mind, or do you do a lot of your placement sort of at the end once architecture is already in place?
I tend to place stuff at the end when the architecture is in place, but then I do change architecture if I think it will make for more interesting fights. Like, the nice thing about Doom is that nothing is ever too set in stone, and it's a lot easier to move things around, like, when compared to something like Quake or what have you, because, like, it's the brushwork is a little bit harder to manipulate and move. I mean, people will block out a lot of that stuff, but Doom's blocking out is mostly, you know, what you see in the final product. So it's just easier to change the environment if you have, like, another encounter in mind. And I do have, like, ideas as I make the map, but you never know how well it'll work out until you start placing the monsters in. So it's just an iterative process of making the fights interesting, and then, like, making sure that the player has, making sure that the player has different threats to contend with at once, or, like, you know, scale that back on the easier difficulties, and then, like, really fuck with the player on, like, the harder difficulties, like, in terms of, like, trying to find what's the more threatening thing to deal with in every encounter. So that's kind of my approach to doing enemy placement. Like, what's the player going to be focusing on as they play? And then that turns into the difficulty settings, that turns into how the final layout of the maps, how the final layouts of the maps come out, and yeah, it's just an iterative process throughout. Like, there is, like, the initial building out part where I just, like, concentrate on architecture, but yeah, once enemies are in the mix and resources and then that stuff, then some tweaking is necessary. From that point forward.
Yeah. I guess this will be sort of a step back in time and then a step forward slightly, but how did you initially get involved with the Adventures of Square?
So Jimmy made the 3-map demo of the Adventures of Square a while back in, I want to say 2012, 2013. And then I loved it so much that I was like, this could be a bigger game. I want in on this. I want to be a part of this. I want to make maps. And a bunch of other people wanted to do that too. So then now we had a team of people to make stuff for the Adventures of Square. And we kind of made it. I pointed out that, like, all you had to do was, like, replace a couple more things and this could be entirely standalone. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing that. And then we were like, I was like, oh wait, a lot of the sounds in this are, like, copyrighted sounds. I have a huge sound library that I use. I'm going to, like, you know, put forth an effort to, like, replace a lot of the sounds and make them fit and whatever. So, I mean, when you're working with something cartoony, it's pretty easy to do sound design because you're going to want to use, like, stock sounds anyway. Yeah. And that made it a little easier. And then I wanted to do, like, some voice acting. So I had, like, a lot of the other characters in the game, like, have, like, pitch shifted voices and different accents or what have you. And then I got, like, you know, Rot King to do additional voices as well, and that kind of fleshed out the whole sound design part of it. But, like, yeah, it came from, I love this thing you made, I want to be a part of this and make more stuff for it because this is unique and interesting. And so it goes.
Mm-hmm. And the Doom Wiki has you listed as doing project management, I guess, as sort of your...
Yeah.
Role on it. What did that actually entail overall, apart from the sound design?
So project management, I think I fell into that because I was handy with Trello, and laying out, like, cards and what people were doing, what needed to be done, and just allocating who is around to do this and who's working on what, so that nobody stepped on each other's toes. And like with the mappers, it was pretty easy because they became, you know, designers of their own map. But then when it came time to like do more gameplay refinements and whatever, it came under like my control or someone else's control if they wanted to revise their work. So it was just a matter of figuring out who was doing what. And that's, you know, it's kind of an unsung job in a lot of like game design, just like the people that are making sure that we have milestones that need to be reached for certain times. Who is working on what, and what skills do people have so that they can be allocated to appropriate tasks. And that's really what project coordination kind of is, because you're not doing, I mean, like for Square, I was doing some creative work and a bunch of managerial work, but it skewed a little bit more managerial for episode one. And then it was kind of 50-50 on episode two. Mm-hmm. As like things started like solidifying after what we made for episode one. So yeah, project coordinators, you need them. They're an invisible role, but you need them.
I think most community projects could probably do with someone in that role.
Oh, absolutely. Like, yeah. I mean, like a lot of community projects like just have like the person that starts it, and then it's like, okay, here's the resources, and then go nuts. But then like it's really like the ones that have like a little bit more, like a little like tighter direction on them, really shine through in terms of like caring about like map progression and having like just an overall, I guess, idea of what the project should be. And like, I mean, nobody wants to like hamstring your creative resources at all, like especially when it's supposed to be like a fun thing. But like when you're making something like a standalone video game, you do need a lot more tighter direction. And like just enough leeway to like throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, because, you know, the mind knows not what the heart wants. You could come up with something really fun and then be like, oh, how could we incorporate that into this? So it's all about finding the balance between your creative team and your direction. And that's always a hard balancing act. But when the effort is put into that, it does tend to shine through in the completed work.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And what were the major differences, I guess, between making maps for Square and then making, you know, regular Doom maps?
With Doom, you already have the resources there at your disposal, and you already know what they are. With Square, you're kind of making it up as you go, and while you have ideas for the different locales, and then as contributed by your mapping staff, sometimes your bestiary may not be done yet, and so you'd have to change the maps later for introducing new enemies or like new weapons. And so when we flesh out the bestiary, we also flesh out the progression in terms of like what weapons should the player have by this point, what enemies should they see by this point, and give that to your mappers. And so like they orchestrate like kind of like the parts of the map that will introduce that new thing or introduce that like new an enemy or weapon. And if they have that in mind, then that does affect a little bit of their design. So yeah, with Square it's entirely new, and with Doom, you know, you're just working with comparatively a completed set, and you're just like you know, making more things that people hopefully haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. And what would you hope to see happen with Adventures of Square in the future? Are there any plans, or is there just you know.
They... Well, yeah, the plans to finish it.
Yeah.
finish episode 3. Uh-huh. But then I also want to see people like make their own maps, and they have with like the with that speed mapping project, Speed Squared. And then I think there's talks of like some other project that may use Square for that, but yeah, we're that's what I want to see. I want to, you know, see the full circle of like me making maps for a thing I like, me making a thing I like, and then seeing people make maps for the thing that I like to make or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to see that cycle complete. And so far I have, and that makes me very happy.
Mm-hmm. So, again, this will sort of jump all over the place, because I guess this is more of like a compilation of things you've worked on over the years, but you've made a lot of like helpful programs for the Doom community over the years. Could you talk a bit about Doom Tools and sort of the major goals for that?
So Doom Tools came about because, well, one year, I think it was back in like 2014, I made like a library for Java for manipulating Doom related data structures and stuff called Doomstruct. And then I made a better version of it in like 2018. Back then I was like, hey, I want to make some utilities. Some people give me ideas of utilities you want to see made. And then people were like, oh, something I could feed a list of textures and have it replace it in a map, or something that counts the things so that I can like remove, see like which maps have like certain objects in it that I wouldn't want in them, and other stuff like stuff that extracts textures that are only used in this map and from other resources and putting it into another WAD file. And then I made a lot of those tools, and then I was just like, for the second iteration, I'm like, well, which are the ones that are the most useful and that I can apply the Unix philosophy of make several utilities and tools, but make them do one thing really, really well. And that design made its way into Doom Tools, which are just like a lot of different separate programs. But when you use them all together, you have this big project building tool chain that you could use for you know, managing your collaborations, and then in the end be able to like just build a demo of what you're working on or a final product of what you're working on, as long as it fits in with the scaffolding of the project. So because like a lot of people assemble their projects in one WAD and like just keep working with like one resource WAD and one mapping WAD, and then they have to like painstakingly throw it all together when they release, and then if something needs to be changed, well, then they have to go do it all over again. And like, I'm sick of that process. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of other people are sick of that process too.
Yep.
So Doom Tools, Doom Tools and Doom Make is the thing that does the project assembling, and that is what I hope more people use, because it works for small projects and very large projects, and mostly for non-Zdoom related projects. Because like with Zdoom, you could just wrap things up in a PK3, which is already an exploded directory of something, and you could use GZDoom to use a directory structure, exploded PK3, for like, you know, testing things and whatnot. Yep. So its tool chain is pretty much there. The thing that needs a lot of help is more the vanilla-er Doom in that direction. So Doom Tools is meant to bridge that sort of gap. And you could still use it with Slade, because Slade looks at directory structures, and you could still use it with DecoHack's part of it, so like its modding code can be like rolled up into the project as well. And it was to making those sorts of projects much easier. And in a day when we're collaborating in different ways, like using Dropbox for people to like throw a lot of things that they're working on together, and then having Doom Tools assemble that whole source directory into like a WAD file, it's now possible. And even to what I would want to use it for, which I already do use it for, is using Git or some other like code revisioning system to commit changes to projects, and then make sure like everybody else can like grab those changes. So right. It's just, it still is a still helps with collaboration. And yeah, that's kind of the goal of Doom Tools, to make collaboration a little bit easier, and so people aren't wrestling with 1 to 2 WAD files in Slade all the time. Nothing against Slade. You still would want to use Slade for a lot of you know, stuff like graphics conversion and other uses, but like, yeah, there has to be a better way than just working with one large WAD file that could corrupt and you lose everything.
Yeah. Well, yeah, on the collaboration front, I've had that experience of like having to constantly send updated versions, and then you've got like 20 different versions of the same file and you're trying to figure out which one is which.
And you gotta make sure everybody's on the same page with like the resource packs and everything. Yeah. But then like if somebody's like, oh, do you have the resource pack? You go, yeah. And you type in DoomMake at the prompt, and then you have like all the stuff made. You go, here you go, here's the texture WAD. Or here you go, here's like what the latest build is. And it's just meant to assist with stuff like that. And I do that all the time. Like I'm currently making something, which was like the reason why I made like Deco Hack and Doom Tools. Like I'm starting to make this like other project that I haven't really told very many people about, but I always have a build ready, so I can just like compile it, and now it's a WAD file, and I could be like, here you go, play this, tell me what you think, and it's easy. It's done in seconds. So yeah, use Doom Tools, everybody. Yeah. And learn how to use it, because I guarantee it will change your workflow for the better.
Yeah. And I also noticed that, I mean, we talked about this at the top of the show, I guess, but I noticed that you're credited with helping with MBF 21. Was that all Decker Hack, or was that other contributions as well?
So MBF 21 was, I mean, I didn't so much contribute to like what to, well, I guess, I was, I guess, a, what I call a ballast for the project. It's like, what can we feasibly port back from, what do we need, and what can we feasibly port back from like later engines into the Boom family engines. And that became MBF 21, and my role was like, what can we feasibly do with like the current utilities, and given my experience in working with all sorts of different engines, how far can we go and how far should we go in terms of completed feature sets. And so, yeah, I was a ballast for the project, not so much a major contributor, but like, oh, maybe we shouldn't go too far in some of these places. And, yeah, that was my role.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely excited about MBF 21, and sort of the feature list that's coming out for that. What are your sort of hopes for that format, I guess, in terms of its potential? Like, are you hoping that it would end up being more of a middle ground between ZDoom and Boom, rather than going full, like, you know, heavy feature compatibility?
I'd like to see it as like that middle ground, because there's a bunch of multiplayer ports that support MBF 21 now. I think Otomex supports it. I don't think Xandro supports it. But like there's a opportunity here for people who suffer from the analysis paralysis of the engines with the greater feature set, to make really cool and interesting things, and still like have like support for making entirely new monsters with entirely different behavior, and so that they don't have to keep using old code pointers that may have been, you know, not really well designed at the time. I guess I don't mean to throw shade on MBF or or what have you, but like we are in a better place now in terms of engine design than a programmer back then becoming their own modder in a way. So like, I mean, it's a bit of a fallacy when people say if you build it they will come. I mean, that only happens if you already have an audience. And so sometimes if you build it, you have to also show people what you can do with it. And I guess that was what Zazer did with Vesper. And that showed off what you could do with MBF-21 weapons and the new sound code pointers and just the expanded amount of frames and states that you could use to make that a reality. And then you see people doing cool stuff with MBF-21 monsters and other things. And so those projects will... And Hordamex. Hordamex is the Odamex Horde mode that also adds a whole lot of new monsters and stuff and maps and MBF-21 features in the multiplayer world. So, yeah, it's growing. It's not growing quickly, but there's stuff out there now that's using that feature set. And I think it'll only grow from that point forward.
Yeah, I've been working with MBF-21 and really enjoying it. I got something brewing.
So. Cool. Can't wait to see it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Doom Radio as a fellow podcaster. How did that begin?
So Doom Radio was around for a while. I forget who started it. I think it was Sarge Baldy, I think. But that was like a long, long time ago. Right. And then Alfonso picked it up. And it was Alfonso and Tango that picked up doing interviews back in around 2010, 2011. And then that turned into like shows like Where's All the Data and what have you. It's not, Doom Radio hasn't been like, you know, a thing for a while now, and I'm glad that, you know, there's people like you, kind of like you and the Bridge Burner and Ty from In the Keep, like kind of like picking up the torch and interviewing some of these like cool community people that make all the stuff like keep your favorite old games alive and the modding scenes alive, as well as making entirely new stuff and being inspired by all those older games that they used to play. And yeah, like even though I feel like my contributions to Doom Radio were like just as like guests and just being a guest on a lot of other people's shows. And like I tried to start a show called Knee Deep in the Code, and it didn't really, I couldn't think of like an episode past the first episode with who I want to interview. Or I wanted to interview more people, but they weren't around. Sometimes it's hard to get programmers to talk about their work and in an accessible way so that the audience isn't put to sleep, because it does get a little jargony at times. But I don't know, maybe I'll start it up again some other day, who knows.
Well, yeah, I did actually listen to that first one with Codeimp, which was interesting, because I remember not only was you know, Doom Builder 2, Doom Builder, like fantastic programs, obviously, especially like I'd come from I talk about this I feel like every episode, but I came from like Doom CAD 95 and then jumped straight to Doom Builder 2, so like
the I jump am so in quality, sorry
yeah
Doom CAD is the absolute worst editor I've ever used.
It's so bad. Yeah, But the jump in quality was pretty immense in terms of my editing experience. And I remember he was like really helpful on the forums and stuff, so yeah, that was an interesting interview to hear from. What was your, I know you only sort of did a little bit of actual interviewing yourself, but what kind of prep work did you tend to do?
Oh man, let's see if I remember. I did have like a sheet of questions that I wanted to ask him, like, yeah, the how do you which was like, where did you get your start? Was it in Doom or was it in programming? And then try to branch off into like other like coding disciplines and design, UI design with like Doom Builder, like stuff I really wanted to ask in. To ask, and I really should have let Zazer in, I think, a little bit more in on the in on the questionnaire stuff as my sidekick, because I don't think he really got too many words in on that episode. So I was just like, oh man, I feel like I really like I didn't mean to like do all the talking, but it just ended up that way.
I think you mentioned that in the episode, actually. I remember.
Yeah, like I try to put a foreword into a lot of episodes just so like the listener can expect something going in, or like what we intend to talk about. And that's always the time to like keep people like give them a warning if there's like any more intense things that people talk about in the podcasts that you do. So yeah, I'm a fan of like the intro and getting people psyched for the rest of the podcast. So that's like what I picked up from listening to other people's podcasts. So like that one little episode is like kind of the pilot for if I ever had a podcast show, it would kind of be like that. So I don't know. That's what you do. You put a bunch of work into it, and if you're proud of it, release it.
Yeah.
And, just like anything else.
Well, I mean, it was interesting, and I've sort of had the thought of like talking to guests who are more involved in sort of the programming aspects and things, but I don't have that background, so it would be very difficult for me to I think come up with like interesting probing questions about a topic like that. So it
Well,
was, yeah.
the nice thing about nerds is that they will love to talk at length about like what they do and what have you. And I mean, even if you have just like a cursory knowledge of what they're talking about, you're still you your role as the interviewer is to learn from them
Yeah, absolutely.
and try to like yeah orchestrate when like the next question should happen or like when the next topic should be. Like, and you're just like kind of the master of ceremonies for like all the topics you want to talk about, and aspects of their work. But yeah, it's people love talking about their work, man. So the it, as long as you're there to learn, then I think you'll be a decent interviewer for those types of interviews as well.
This was also me attempting to push you into doing more of it, you know, get you back into
Oh.
it, you know, however many years
May
later.
Maybe one day.
So I think you've sort of mentioned a few little things, but I was sort of curious what you were working on at the moment. Is it mostly mapping focused or tools focused?
Every once in a while it's tools focused. I'm kind of winding down on that just a tiny bit at the moment. I am working on another project at the moment that I can't talk about. At least like I don't think I can talk about it. Like you'll eventually see that work one day. But I'm kind of involved in like yeah, kind of a secret type of project.
Wow.
That is first person shooter related.
Okay.
And I don't know how my work will end up in the final product, but it will. And you'll figure out what the heck that is. And then, like, yeah, I'm working on another Doom-related project for Vanilla Doom and using a whole lot of dehackedry and whatnot. And I've sent some people demos of that, but yeah, I'm just waiting to hear what they think of it before moving forward. So yeah, all the stuff I'm working on right now is either out or I want to keep secret for now.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm definitely someone who doesn't like to give too much away either until the thing comes out.
Yeah. I'm terrible at promotion.
Yeah. it's tough, right? I mean, you have to give enough so that it's interesting, but you don't want to give out too much because then people get sick of hearing about it, kind of thing.
Yeah, that too.
So to the final question of the podcast, the big one. What is your favorite Doom monster and why?
My favorite Doom monster.
It can be aesthetically or to use in a map or gameplay wise, whatever.
I really like Revenants because they force the player to move. Like they're basically a demon with a seeker rocket. And you can use them just as like really asshole turrets, like like in areas of the map that are like out of the player's reach. But then if you put them on the ground and make the player constantly move, you can chase them into other hazards and what have you. So a moving player is a challenged player. So yeah, I'm going with Revenant. They have just the right amount of hit points to be threatening, and just the right set of skills to also be threatening to the player, but not like terribly threatening once you know how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm. Always a solid choice. I thought we might get our first like hit scan lover. I thought you might be like chain gunner or shotgun guy or something. Which
nah, fuck those guys. those are jerks. Although the thing I'm working on makes the chain gunner even worse. So look out for that.
Great, very excited to experience that. I think that's what people have been asking for years, actually, for the chain gunner to be a worse enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. It was great. I feel like we actually got through your career in record time.
Yeah.
A lot of questions.
Oh, yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Yeah, it was really fun. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. I will be back next time with another guest. That will be next week. And, yeah, appreciate you all. And goodbye.